Hugo Wintonhour with Canadian Sunset. In honor of our Canadian guest today.
Thank you very much.
From Toronto?
Yes, I grew up in Toronto. I lived there for 35 years. I guess that's sort of yes to Toronto. Okay.
Yeah.
28 years. I get there at 7. I'm being boring. Canadian Sunset. Are you saying my sun is setting?
No.
Thank you.
Also, are you going to be playing any songs that mention Elkins Park?
No.
That's where I'm from.
Elkins Park. Sorry. Jeez, I didn't get the memo.
All right.
Elkins Park Sunset. You know an Elkins Park Sunset?
It's a very famous song.
There's a ukulele
in Elkins Park, as it turns out. Yeah.
We have got David and Kevin here from tonight's presentation of the greatest story ever out of Bedford Falls. Do we know what state Bedford Falls is in? Connecticut or Pennsylvania?
Maybe in Pennsylvania.
I am assuming it was very close to Elkins Park, Pennsylvania, of course.
Oh, okay. Okay. I remember hearing the production, both now in the movie, Stewart and Donna Reed, they were both from small towns. So they had that nice sort of feel to it. I think Lionel Barrymore didn't believe that Donna Reed was from a small town until she proved it by milking a cow, like on a bet.
Oh, Hollywood. Show me you can milk a cow and you've got the role.
There we go.
Am I making this up? Am I lying? Or did the set from Gremlins... Did they take some of the set from It's a Wonderful Life to film the small town of Gremlins? The Steven Spielberg, the producer, I have a feeling I read this 30 years ago, that he used some of the It's a Wonderful Life set for that.
I have absolutely no idea if that is true.
The more I said aloud, the more I think that I may be right.
But you've just mentioned earlier, as we were coming into the studio, that you never lie to me, so...
Well, this is why I'm saying, all right, I'm sorry, I take back the word lie. Am I mistaken?
It could be true.
I have a feeling, or was it inspired by? We're Googling furiously.
We're Googling, yes. Tonight at the Alberta Rose, you're going to be presenting a live to the audience radio play.
Exactly, as if the audience were back in time in the 1940s and they had been invited to be in the studio audience of an actual Lux Radio Theater broadcast. So they'll see the cast in these fabulous outfits. We'll be standing in front of these deluxe old school microphones. We'll be reading from the scripts as the actors did.
And if everybody has size 8.5 shoes that looks like it's from the 40s, please bring them.
Yeah. Kevin forgot to bring dress shoes.
Oh.
And slacks. And a hat. But listen, besides that, it's going to be a really fun show tonight. I think we can all confirm that much is true. Yeah. So, the audience will be transported. We're going to be having sound effects and music piped in, so everything will be seamlessly synchronized, and the audience will have both the experience of being in a live radio theater audience and laughing their butts off.
Well, the Alberta Rose is a great place to put this sort of show on because it's got a nice tall ceiling, but it holds a nice crowd of people.
It is. It's a very intimate house for it being a 300-seat theater. Livewire, which is a very popular radio show here in Portland, records their shows there. And so it's a really warm, lovely room. We're thrilled to be there.
So when did this idea come about to do this?
So essentially, this started more than 20 years ago. I explained this to Ken last week. So a buddy of mine named Robin Jones started the show. And Robin just put a bunch of his friends together in a bookstore in Los Angeles, printed out scripts, and found transcriptions. And they just kind of would perform for the customers at a Porter's Books in Los Angeles. And no one was really paying much attention, but some of his friends were these up-and-coming comedians and actors. And, it came to pass that he invited me to sit in with the cast when he had moved it to a very small theater called the Fake Gallery, which is now no longer there on Melrose and Heliotrope in Los Angeles. And I loved the show so much because it was scripted but kind of improvised. There was music. It was like a throwback to an old variety show.
So you started right then, like getting the script, but not staying on the script.
Yeah, and he didn't even give us the scripts until we arrived at the theater. So there was no rehearsal involved. The rehearsal was sound check. So we had 45 or 60 minutes. He'd give us a few notes, and then we were live. So the take on it was like super fresh. Accidents would occur, people would go up on their lines, but the accidents kind of got worked into the improv, and it became this wholly other thing. It was
a sort of Brechtian thing.
Yeah,
it was like knowing you're in a theater watching people perform.
Yeah. And when Robin and his wife left town, I said, what's going to happen to the show? It's the greatest thing since sliced bread. I mean, I've been doing theater for 30-plus years. I thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever been a part of. He said, well, you take it. So this was, you know, just after the year 2000, give or take. So I've been producing it ever since. But I've kind of kept his formula in place. We don't really rehearse. We show up for sound check. We kind of get into character. And then we're live. And so it's really fresh and immediate.
Now, you're going to be having stand-up mics. And yep. People are going to be around the mic as opposed to everyone sitting in a chair. Like Kevin, you do a lot of voice work.
I do. Yes, I do.
They put you in a room by yourself. You don't even see the rest of the cast.
They put you, Disney, they put you in a room by yourself in Nickelodeon. They put you with the cast.
Okay.
Disney, they want to honor, I'm using the word honor a lot. Eight and a half shoes. They want to honor the way Walt Disney did it. And Walt Disney insisted on doing one actor at a time.
Oh, okay.
But Nickelodeon does a lot of actors. There.
Well, Disney, he would have like Hans Conry and
right.
Everett Horton back there.
You're right, but by themselves.
Yeah.
I love
Warners, yeah. They would like for the cast of like Teen Titans, they would all be together.
Yeah,
yeah. Do it like that.
Both ways are good. I like both ways for different reasons.
But for the classic old-time radio, you had the announcer mic and then a mic that the cast would use, and then there'd be a couple mics on the sound effects table. What's the most outlandish or most difficult sound effect for tonight's show?
Well, first of all, we do not have a live Foley artist.
Oh, okay.
As a result of not really rehearsing, to have a live Foley artist,
right.
Which we've tried before, it was a complete and utter disaster.
Oh, it must have been hilarious.
It was the opposite of hilarious, as it turns out. It was just terrible.
But you've learned your lesson.
We did, yeah. We decided to not engage in a crap show anymore. So everything is piped in. So the real challenge is finding accurate sounds. So if I'm not recording the sounds myself, I'm trading sounds with other sound creators, layering them in to create the effects that we want. We try to honor the original music as much as possible, however. So, yeah. And as far as one mic for the announcer and one for the cast, we just all use the same mics.
Oh, okay. Now, so then all the music is going to be on some sort of recording device?
Yep.
Yes. And it's all lined up. So we have somebody on the record, on the playback.
Our dearly departed sound engineer, Dan Fogel, whose audio montage is almost as good as the one you let us into your show
with,
is a tribute to old-time radio. Well, Dan sort of created this custom cueing system, which has been refined over the years since he died, and we continue to use that, and it kind of seamlessly integrates with the show. It's fabulous.
Oh. Now, you know that Ken and I both put on sort of radio theater. Ken does.
I should add, though, and David mentioned this last week, that Robin Jones, who he mentioned as the founder of fake radio in this concept, his brother, Brendan Jones, lives in Portland and is one of the creators of Tesla City Stories.
Oh.
And they do 1940-style live radio theater.
Where do they do theirs?
They were doing it at the defunct Fremont Theater.
Yeah,
okay. up until November.
About a month ago, yeah.
Right, and they went out of business, but they're looking for another venue, and they'll do it monthly once they find one.
Oh, wow. You don't even have to have radio to do radio theater anymore.
I know. It's really great.
So you called up Kevin. What did you just like? Did he just call you up? Just like, how did the
In an email kind of way. and I saw him last year in January. I was here in Portland, and maybe that reminded you of me.
Yes. I also, given that
Do you remember what you said to me after the show? I'm obsessed, so I'll never forget. We improvised together, and he said to me, I don't remember you were so big. You're really broad. You were very big. That's
In terms of your physical
performance.
Size,
no, performance. Your performance. It's really big. No, good for you. Good for you. Excellent. Being that brave to go. I wouldn't be that brave to go that big. Wow, yeah. I guess you are pretty broad.
Are you sure I wasn't kidding, given that all of your traditional characters are huge? Or was I actually being serious?
You were actually being serious. Knowing how big I was, you were so surprised how big I was.
Let that be a lesson.
Seriously.
Size 8.5 shoes. Keep going. I'm sorry.
I met Kevin and Dave Foley through Mark McKinney. And so at some point, those three gents have sat in with the show. And when I was conceiving about bringing the show to Portland for the first time, I wanted someone to guest star with us, A, who'd already been in the show, and Kevin's been on a few shows with us and has...
I'm raising my hand.
That's true. Everyone on radio can see it.
Yes.
It's down the hall.
Thank you. I'll be back in 45 minutes.
And I wanted someone who was just fluent in comedy.
Oh, so now you've been doing this show in Portland, or you've been doing it in Los Angeles?
No, this is our first ever performance in Portland. We've been performing in L.A. for over 20 years, and because this is our first show here in town, I really wanted someone who epitomized what we do and how we do it. And, you know, Kevin's a legendary comic performer. It was a perfect match if he were available. And he was. So I was thrilled and honored, of course. Yeah,
so what you're doing is, you said, the Lux Radio Theater. And you're going to have the commercials, the soap commercials.
Yeah.
They're going to be saying stuff like, you know, before the war, when there was lots more Lux soap around, or
yeah,
stuff like that.
Yeah, the commercials for my money are the funniest parts of the show, because it's just stuck in time in this very unique and very charming but slightly offensive way.
Well, we've been playing the Isle of a Mystery dramas here on the sampler, because they're only like 10, 15 minutes. And we will have a drama later this afternoon, later in the show.
Wow. Which one?
We're going to play Johnny Dollar.
Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. The man with the action-packed expense account. But there was an earlier version of one of the Isle of a Mystery shows. There was a commercial for someone like Fleischmann's Yeast.
Fleischmann's yeast. That's
and
right.
It was like, you know, it's like it gives you energy and it's for your mind and stuff. And some person, this is like 1939, 1940, the guy says, well, you know, with those countries that were invaded in Europe, if they'd have just had Fleischmann's yeast in their diet, maybe they wouldn't have been invaded.
Like I'm telling you, these commercials and the copy, they were just, I mean, come on. Lucky Strike's motto was Lucky Strike means fine tobacco.
LSMFT.
That's right.
Yes.
LSMFT.
Right. And many doctors recommend the T-zone. It stimulates the T-zone.
The taste zone.
Taste zone around your mouth.
Ah.
And so if you want your meal to taste better, have a Camel or a Lucky Strike there.
Yeah, so I mean, if you can conceive of how commercials for tobacco products used to sound and then translate that to a toilet soap, which is what they called Lux, you can kind of guess how ludicrous tonight's commercials are going to be when we go live.
There was the show Inner Sanctum with the squeaking door.
All right.
Mm-hmm. And for a while it was sponsored by Lipman Tea. And so they would have this tea lady who would co-host it with the host who's trying to be all ghouly and was going to scare you. And then this woman is almost like the church lady. She's going, well, if they just sat down and had a good cup of tea, it would be so horrible. And says, well, I'm trying to scare you. Well, just have some tea. You're not scaring me. And it's like the weekly opening to the show.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a day that's long gone. The Lux Radio Theater was one of those shows that would dramatize movies with the original cast, which is one of the reasons they moved the broadcast test for National Broadcasting Company and others moved to Hollywood
as opposed
to San Francisco.
They are now, or the old building is now known as the Ricardo Montalban Theater, which is on Vine between Sunset and Hollywood, which, by the way, reopened only a few years ago, and we'd love to perform there and are trying to figure out a way to get a Lux Radio Theater performance back in that building.
Is Bordner still open?
Bordner?
Yeah. Isn't that it, Bordner's?
Oh, Borders, the bookstore, yeah.
No, the bar.
Oh, the bar.
Oh, okay, never mind. Okay, I guess the frolic room is still there by the palace. I guess you don't get out much there.
You know, I'm in my 40s. I don't go out drinking much anymore.
I see.
Capitol Records, is that still there?
Capitol Records, yes, that is still there.
There.
It's in that little town east of West Hollywood, isn't
it? Okay.
Yeah.
Did Jimmy Stewart do this radio?
He did. Both Jimmy and Donna reprised their roles as George and Mary Bailey. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At this point, the Lux Radio Theater was known for having Cecil B. DeMille as the host, but this he had stopped by this time. They had another guy.
He did. He got into a contract dispute with the Lux Radio Theater, and they kind of said, thank you very much, goodbye, and they brought in a gentleman named William Keeley, who then also served as producer of the show for a very long period of time.
Yeah, DeMille would come on, and he would make it sound like he's the one who was putting together this radio play for the audience. But no, he just came in and
He just came in 5 minutes before the show and read the
script. Exactly. He he was essentially the Orson Welles of, you know, I'm the producer, and it didn't work out forever, and they parted company.
Now, as I've been reading on It's a Wonderful Life, it wasn't that big a hit, mainly because it came out with so much competition. The movie,
and also it was dark. It was I think it was too dark for people to accept Jimmy Stewart at that point, I think.
Well, also, the movie it was competing against also was Best Years of Our Lives, which is a
great movie.
Yeah, and that like got the Oscars. So they wanted to get it released in 1946, so they put it out in December instead of waiting till when they wanted to release it in January.
It's also a long movie. Yeah. Isn't it like 2.5 hours or something?
It's fairly long, yeah, and as you said, it's dark. There weren't a lot of movies then or even now that kind of casually talk about the concepts of suicide or not knowing your place in the world and in life and kind of going off the rails a little bit. Certainly not talking about angels.
Right.
No, but it is in that sort of two sides of the small town that you see in the movie we were talking about earlier, Shadow of a Doubt.
Yes.
But also a Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
And just recently in Twin Peaks as well.
Mm-hmm.
That it looks very nice and the pie's great and let's have some more coffee. But then, meanwhile, there's like the drug dealers coming over from the border.
Right. It was certainly dark for Frank Capra, for sure, like the dark side. Yeah, because he had that Frank Capra-esque kind of small town, the cops singing happy that the cab driver happy that they're going to marry. And then the, as you said, the suicide element of it, the losing everything. But also the greatest thing about the movie to me is what it's about. I guess it's about a few things, but the thing that I remember the most is that it's about that we all touch each other's lives. And you can't take away someone from the world without it being like a house of cards and dominoes and affecting everyone. And
An amazing message.
Yeah.
And I think there's for good reason why it's kind of become part of the holiday canon in this country. There's just this amazing, beautiful message that everyone can wrap their head around and embrace no matter what your background is.
Now, I want to mention once again, it was from a short story called The Greatest Gift. Philip Van Doren Stem, who wrote it, a number of other books, he says it was kind of inspired a little bit by
Christmas Carol.
A Christmas Carol, yes, exactly.
That would make sense.
Instead of a ghost, it's an angel.
Yes.
Now, the question, though, about this movie is, which is the Hell Town? Is it Pottersville or is it really Bedford Falls?
Oh.
My vote is Pottersville. Yeah. Because in everyday life, there's always, you know, some mix of good and bad. But George's life is way better in Bedford Falls than it is in Pottersville.
Well, yeah. So the argument that Bedford Falls is really the bad place is because everyone's got to pretend to be so happy and they got to, like, follow the rules. And not, whereas in Pottersville, let's party.
But all the houses look the same.
Yeah,
it's for the benefit of one rich man. I go with David.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
I guess we're not cynical.
Excellent. So it may be dark, but it's not cynical.
Right.
The movie, I always felt that it was the television replays that saved it. Because unlike a lot of other films, it was an independent production by Frank Capra after he had done all of the propaganda movies in World War II, and he started his own company.
Why We Fight, right? He did that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he had, was no longer at Columbia. He was on his own. The studios had lost the trust suit against them. They had to relinquish all their theaters.
Right.
And so a lot of independence began to emerge at that point. And Capra tried it with his Liberty Films. And so he got this script from RKO, and then RKO was going to distribute it. And they're the ones who decided to just put it out earlier than expected. So it didn't make back all the money it needed to, because other films just go see.
And he eventually had to become sort of a hired hand by his standards, didn't he, when he didn't make that much money.
My wife would hate me if I didn't mention this, because Capra himself was Italian. And so the story, if you go back and look at it, is actually extremely Italian-American friendly. So the character of Martini and his family and him being such a close friend of George Bailey. And on the other side of the spectrum, you've got old man Potter, who in one scene refers to George Bailey as playing nursemaid to a bunch of garlic eaters, which in the 1940s was a terrible slang to call Italian Americans. So Capra was attempting to, in his own way, use his own identity and family history to make a statement that Italians had made this wonderful contribution to the world, and I believe pulled it off.
Now, as I was saying with the Liberty films, so later when movies were being shown on television, television needed movies to fill up the times that they had. Unlike a lot of other films, this film was, the ownership was a little different. So it probably got picked up and shown on television
right.
a lot more and built up an audience with our generation seeing it and recognizing the value of the movie.
I remember seeing this on TV all the time, especially this time of year. So you're probably right.
Yeah. And then especially like Donna Reed had her own show. And Jimmy Stewart had done a few TV shows. He was still, even into the 70s, he was still doing stuff.
Yeah.
So you're going to do a radio version now, Kevin. You're going to be doing the Jimmy Stewart.
I'm not. No. I'm going to be Clarence.
The angel. You're going to be the angel.
Yes, yes.
Oh, good. You can be broad.
Well, but within the lines. What's inherent in the script? I'm going to do that.
Well, I'm playing Joseph, your supervisor. All right, so. Sir. We'll see what happens
there. We'll see what happens.
Oh, so you will.
If you force me to ad lib, I will.
I didn't listen to the radio play. Does it start with the narration or the voiceover?
Yeah,
exactly.
As the
movie does?
Essentially, the backbone of the story is Clarence, our angel second class, who's our hero, and his supervisor, Joseph, who is essentially giving him George Bailey's case history and explaining to him George's life up until the moment where George is just about ready to consider taking his life and then deploys Clarence to save him. So there's a whole bunch of scenes in between all of the explaining of Bailey's life that it's just Clarence and Joseph. So
right.
Yeah.
All right, we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens.
I just remember, I won't say any names, but I was filming a TV pilot. We were at the read-through part. And I won't say the names, but one very famous comedian A, said, I think the script needs a rewrite. I always go back to this. What's it about? What's It's a Wonderful Life about? It's about Clarabelle trying to get his wings. And another very famous comedian said, first of all, no, it isn't. And second of all, it's Clarence.
I would have.
In now, the car, I'll tell you the famous
in the
name.
Car, yeah. That's,
you know,
that's
for
great.
Movies in the 40s, they did a lot of use of flashbacks, a lot more than they did in the 30s. And so this movie has got a major, almost flashback dream sequence slash other dimension segment in it, a sort of what if alternate time thing. And audiences had been cued into that through the whole decade. The flashbacks and interesting dream sequences and alternative forms of narrative, like starting with the narration, the disembodied voices as it does. It's similar to the opening of Our Town, a very influential film on movies of the way they were done. So, you know, for your play, but also folks probably are going to go out and find the movie as well.
Yeah.
Out there.
It is a dark Our Town.
Yeah.
Lux Radio also did a version of Our Town as well. Not surprising. It was a well-received movie, and radio wanted to copy whatever it could.
So what was one thing in the script that you got, oh, we have to change this? Is there one that comes to mind?
There is one thing that I felt was a little bit more clear in the movie than it was in the radio script. And there's a scene in both the movie and now in our radio script version where Bailey essentially goes on his hands and knees to old Bam Potter. $8,000 has gone missing in an accident, and he goes to the only guy in town who's got that amount of money, Vladimir Putin. Excuse me,
right.
Old Man
old
Potter.
Man.
So Potter essentially reads him the riot act, and at the end of the scene, after describing why he shouldn't do it, picks up the phone and calls the police because he's a trustee of the building and loan. And that scene, as written, was never in the radio script. So we selectively brought that over because it's such a powerful good versus evil scene that it really helps to shape the narrative of the story.
It drives Jimmy Stewart to the brink, right?
And drives him to the brink, exactly. That's the darkest moment that leads him to, I guess I won't be able to take care of my family, and therefore my life must be surrendered.
Yes. I remember being when I saw the movie when I was like 10 for the first time, that scene was very upsetting and very important.
Plus Lionel Barrymore in the movie was just, he's this super imposing figure. Yeah.
Even though he's in a wheelchair.
I know, but still, and that face and the voice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's... That, I think it's a lot of Lionel Barrymore movies, but I think that's the one that got Joe Flaherty to do Guy Caballero of SCTV.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
That's what that's he's doing. He's doing Lionel Barrymore, and It's Wonderful
Life. I did not know that.
That I know for sure.
All right.
I may be wrong about Gremlins, but that's for sure.
No, you're right, actually. I
looked that up. Am I right?
Yeah, you're right.
So that scene was not in the radio play. I wonder if there was some influence, because I've read that the FBI kind of thought this movie was suspect. Because, you know, the character played by Lionel Barrymore makes rich people look like they're bad
right.
and evil. And that's what the communists do to undermine our American society.
So did maybe, they go after Capra and put him on the...
No, maybe the, you know, when they were going to do the radio play, it was like, let's make sure that the whole play is all American.
Well, his movies in the 30s were thought of as socialist, by the way. Did you ever see the movie from one of the kids in Hall, Dave Foley, called The Wrong Guy, where he sort of takes that from It's Wonderful Life, but it's the evil farmers trying to run the nice bankers out of town. And Joe Flaherty actually plays the sort of Lionel Barrymore evil farmer.
You keep mentioning Joe Flaherty. Was he the one at the table read that made the comment about It's a Wonderful Life?
It was not. He was not.
All right. Well, you'll have to tell me in the car then.
I'll tell you later.
All right. We'll see about that.
So who else is in the cast tonight that you brought that people in town might know?
So people in town would know. So our cast is divided between my L.A. cast and my Portland peeps. So appearing with us in Portland are Beau Brousseau, Talon Bigelow, Carrie Leak, Betsy Green, Sam Mowry, the creator and director of the Willamette Radio Workshop, who's an incredible voice talent, and also one of my students. I teach improv at St. Andrew's Nativity School, which is a Jesuit middle school in the Northeast. One of my students will be appearing on stage playing the young George Bailey tonight, and his name is Aaron Leonard. Yeah, Aaron Leonard.
Now, in the movie, the druggist, that was played by H.B. Warner, wasn't it?
Oh, that's H.B. Warner. I think you're right.
Mr. Gower.
Yeah, and then he, earlier, I think he was like a matinee idol in like the silent or on the stage.
I think it does ring a bell.
And then...
that's a pretty dark scene, too, when he gets mad at...
He slaps the kid across the face. Dark,
Which gives him that bad ear, so he cannot go into the army. Like everyone else is doing, or the Navy.
I'd love to read the short story to see how much is different from the movie. I'd love to.
So, again, tonight at the Alberta Rose Theater.
Tonight and tomorrow night,
yes.
Alberta Rose Theater. Wednesday night at Bag and Baggage Theater, at their new theater called The Vault. That's on Main Street in Hillsboro.
And that's sold out, isn't
it? It is sold out. We still have tickets for tonight and tomorrow. All information is at our website, fakeradio.net.
Oh, great. Well, David.
Size 8.5 shoes.
Kevin needs some nice 40 shoes.
We need a George Bailey moment for you.
One thing, David, you forgot to mention the musical act, which is a Portland act.
Opening the show tonight will be Portland's own Libertine Bells. And they are a trio of gals who sing and are extremely reminiscent
I've had
the
them
old...
on the show.
Oh, well, then you know who I'm talking about. Yeah, so they are reminiscent of
the Lemon Sisters?
Andrew Sisters.
I mean, Andrew Sisters.
And are spot on. So they'll be doing a song for us this evening.
So you didn't get the ukuleles.
We did
but
not
But that's like a 12-piece band.
It is. And Teresa Boyd is in both ukuleles
that's what I
and
mean. Yeah,
Libertine Bells. And she is a Portland multi-talent for sure.
As my mom would say, she's a pistol.
She is a pistol. And she and her boyfriend Greg Hyatt are both multi-talented.
Yeah, we've had them in here with Saloon Ensemble.
Oh, very nice.
Well, David and Kevin, I hope you have a great show.
Thank you.
Kevin needs what type of shoe again?
They got to look like they're from the 40s, and they're size 8.5.
Just bring them to the theater tonight.
Also, bananas for the smoothies that I make in my hotel room. I brought a blender. Bananas in size 8.5 shoes.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for coming by.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate you having us in.
You are listening to the Monday Sampler.